It'd be my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Pam W. from San Diego. Come back up. Let's do this again.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pam, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pam.
Thank you, John, for inviting me to come. And thanks to Pamela for coming down here and supporting me tonight. Congratulations to everyone who's new and visiting and taking a token. Dave's my good friend. Like, I think Dave was probably at Old Town Speakers meeting the first time I went to Old Town Speakers meeting. And Dave's been a part of my sobriety. I've gotten to see all of his achievements. I'm deciding if I want to list them or not, but like, he graduated from college. We had a party. I was at the party. He got a job. He got a good job, you know, like Dave and I, he didn't come to any of my weddings though, but but there are a couple of people in AA that did, but Dave didn't. But anyway, congratulations to my good friend Dave. Love you, Dave. And let's see. I'm never good starting out, so I'll just get right to it, okay, you guys? I am originally from Evansville, by God, Indiana. I call it that because there was a lot of God going on back there. My mom was a Baptist preacher's daughter who never had a drink of alcohol in her entire life. And my dad was a thirsty fella. And how that affected me is, like, there was an obsession with alcohol in my home. Like, mom did not allow dad to drink in the house, but every week when dad got paid, he'd take his check, he'd go to the tavern with my uncles, they'd drink, they'd play music, they'd tell jokes until mom found them, you know what I'm saying? How that affected me is, like, when I looked at mom and dad, mom was really overly responsible and often pissed off. Sorry if that's harsh, but it could be worse, the words that I use, you know what I'm saying? Like, but she was really unhappy, and she was really mad, and she was really mad at dad all the time. And dad was a guitar playing, joke telling, fun kind of guy. And I wanted to be like dad, you know, from a very young age. So anyway, and me as a kid, I remember looking at my cousin Sherry, and cousin Sherry and me couldn't be more opposite. Like, she was smaller, she was older than I was, but she was smaller than me. She had big brown eyes, long dark eyelashes, big mop of brown curly hair, just beautiful. And I was chubby and bigger than her, and blue eyes and pale and blonde hair. And I just remember thinking, if I could just be her, I'd be okay. And I don't think anybody did that to me, you know. I think somehow I came out the chute wired that way, you know. And it affected a lot of things, like the circumstances of me being brought up affected me, and then how do I say this? Like I wasn't popular in school. Kids didn't like me, but that didn't stop me from wanting to be the center of attention. You know what I'm saying? And the kids could like feel me coming, and they were like, "Oh no, I don't like that. I don't want, keep that away." You know? So what I'm saying is I could have used a drink at 4, but I held off till I was 11, okay? I had my first drink at 11. I very specifically remember the drink. I remember exactly where I was because alcohol was such a big deal in my home. So I had my first drink at 11, and what it did for me, like, some of you guys will remember this. There used to be this commercial, and it was, "How do you spell relief?" And it was R-O-L-A-I-D-S. Well, my version of that commercial is, "How do you spell relief? A-L-C-O, how do you spell alcohol?" But you know what I'm saying, like, what? Because what it did for me is, like, it took me from being this really self-conscious person who constantly always thought that nobody liked her and nobody wanted her around, to be able to be in the moment and just relax and have a good time. I could laugh out loud, and I didn't think that somebody thought that I was laughing too loud or they didn't like my laugh or something like that. That's what alcohol did for me, you know? And I didn't start drinking every day, but I did have my first blackout when I was 15, and I joined the Navy when I was 17. My first duty station was New Orleans, Louisiana. I know, I went from Baptist preacher's daughter in control of my life to New Orleans, Louisiana. And I arrived there on New Year's Eve, 1983. And I hooked up with some sailors in the barracks. They're like, we're going to the French Quarter to party. Do you want to come? Of course I did. Yes, of course. And, you know, by the end of the night, I was drinking hurricanes and shooting oysters on the half shell, you know. And up until that time, the only seafood I'd ever come across was fried catfish. So it was a big leap, is what I'm saying, you guys. I became a bar drinker. I loved everything about drinking in the bars. And I had a friend, I had a close girlfriend, and Thursday nights in New Orleans was ladies' nights, and me and my friend, we would get together, and we would figure out what we were going to wear, and we would have a couple, and we'd start drinking, and we'd start talking about who we hoped was going to be there that night, who we hoped wasn't going to be there that night, and what new adventure might occur this exciting Thursday night, right? So, and then we would go to the club on base. We go to the enlisted club on base to see if there were any Marines that might want to happen to party with us. If they did, we'd scoop them up. We hit a couple of ladies' nights, and we always ended up at Scratch's Pub. And at Scratch's Pub on ladies' night, the ladies got 3 free drinks, a red carnation, and a male strip show. Yes, exactly that order. I'm not talking Chippendales, you guys. I'm talking about drunk guys from the bar that want to get up on stage and strip. And that's what I did every Thursday night. And somehow I made it to muster 7 o'clock in the morning the next morning. And I don't know how I did that. I would have a hard time doing that today, getting somewhere at 7 o'clock, especially if you expected me to have makeup on and hair done, you know? So I'm impressed that I was able to make it to, I have to attribute it to youth. I just don't understand how I did it, but I didn't get in trouble for drinking, but I would go to work drunk and hungover. And then I would beg my chief to let me go. I'd be like, Chief, let me have an early jump. We called it an EJ. Let me have an EJ on the weekend. Let me go. And I would beg him to let me go. And he wouldn't let me go because he knew I was hungover and drunk. So he'd make me stay all day. And then, you know, I would do this thing. I would go, oh, I'm not going out tonight. I'm staying home. I mean, like, I know it's Friday night and it's like a sin to not go out on a Friday night, but I'm going to stay home tonight. And then this miracle would happen. Somewhere around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, somewhere between 3 and 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Fridays, I would get the second wind, and it would go something like this. It would go, I can't stay home tonight. It's Friday. I'm going out. And then, you know, I would just do the weekend, you know. And so what ended up happening for me, how that all played out is, like I said, I was a blackout drinker and a bar drinker. So if you're a female and you're a bar drinker and you're blacking out, you're what I call popular. And I was. So I decided I had to do something about my drinking. So I got married. These are alcoholic solutions, you guys. So I got married, and I married this Marine. He had just graduated from the Naval Alcohol Rehabilitation Program. in Jacksonville, Florida. And he was looking for a higher power, and I was looking for someone to control and enjoy. We got married. So what happened with that is he would tell me, he would say, I'm going to go to the A&A meeting tonight. That's the way we said it back then. He'd say, I'm going to go to the A&A meeting tonight. And I'd say, oh, I know you are, because I'm going to go with you. Because I don't know what kind of girls you girls are, but like, I like to know what my man was up to. You know what I'm saying? So I went to the A&A meeting with him. And, you know, it really worked out well for me because, like, my husband was in a lot of trouble for his drinking. He had gone to office hours in front of the colonel. He was in a lot of trouble, and he was trying to not get kicked out of the Marine Corps. And that worked out well for me because when I went to meetings, nobody told me I was an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful for that because if anybody would have told me I was an alcoholic, I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. I party on the weekends. I go to work on time. I pay my bills. I ain't got no problems. So that's what I would have said, but I didn't have to say it because no one was paying any attention to me, which usually doesn't go well. But at this moment, it worked out well for me because what I heard when I went to the meetings with him is I heard about the phenomenon of craving. And I identified with the phenomenon of craving because once I started drinking, I didn't want to stop. And I drank until I blacked out, passed out, and came to, you know? And I identified with that. And I wasn't ready to quit drinking. It was still paying off enough for me that I wasn't willing to give it up. It's very sad. Like, I look back on it now, you know, I had an alcoholic husband who's trying to stay sober, and I didn't want to quit drinking on the weekends. So anyway, it didn't work out for us. I didn't stay sober. He didn't get sober. I drank through that divorce. I drank for 7 more years. I crossed all kinds of lines with my drinking. I cross all kinds of lines that I'm really glad my Baptist mom doesn't know about, okay? And I ended up stationed here in San Diego, and I was engaged to this guy. I work a couple programs. You guys might figure it out before it's all over. Anyway, so I was engaged to another guy, and he got kicked out of the Navy because he had tried to commit suicide. And he wasn't working, and he didn't work for like 9 months. And I was mad. I was really mad. And I was trying not to drink. I would only drink on special occasions, you know, like birthdays or weddings or the Hank Williams Jr. concert. And when I did drink, you know, I was trying not to drink because what I found out is that if you're married, if I was married and I drink, I could still be popular. So I didn't want to do that. You know what I mean? So I was trying not to drink. I was trying not to drink all the time. I only wanted to drink on special occasions. And then I would, you know, just get blackout, pass out. Drunk. And so I was also eating. I put on like 30 pounds because I was so mad at this guy because he wouldn't get a job and go to work. And so I ended up in this other 12-step program. And in that 12-step program, I was supposed to have, I had a sponsor in that program, and we made a plan. And the plan was to have one glass of wine with dinner. That was the plan. So I reported back the next day. I said, I know I said I was only going to have one glass of wine, but I had two. And she was like, she had a lot of questions about that second glass of wine. And by the end of the questions, I admitted that I had gotten an entire bottle of wine into those two glasses. And she thought that was excessive. And she asked me, she said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes. And like I had known since New Orleans that I was an alcoholic, but I hadn't been willing to do anything about it. And you know, my mom always called my dad an alcoholic. I just said, yeah. And when I said yes, I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. But that second part of step one, that my life was unmanageable, I didn't believe that, not for a minute, not for a second. Actually, and I'm just going to tell you the truth because I was new and this is how I was back then. And I really thought that I was going to be good and God was going to give me what I wanted. And I had a list of things that I wanted, you know? And I really feel like, at least for me, God knew exactly how to handle me. You know what I'm saying? So I basically got almost everything off the list that I wanted. And what happened was, is like the hole on the inside of me kept getting bigger and bigger because I did not want a spiritual solution to my problem. I already had been brought up with a spiritual solution. And when you guys said spiritual, I knew what you meant. I knew you really meant religious. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to do that. Okay. And so anyway, and also like the what I had modeled for me was religious or spiritual was you work hard, you're miserable, you die, and then you get your rewards in heaven. And I was like, no thanks. You know what I'm saying? I want to have a good time now. You know, I already told you guys that. So I really, the spiritual part of this program, I was like, forget you, you know? And I would be going to meetings and everybody would be talking about, oh, if you're an alcoholic, you need a spiritual solution, you're a problem. I thought, easy for you to say. I'd say that too if I had your house and your husband and your car, you know? I was really mad. I was really mad. I was like 3 years and 3 months sober. And I married my last good idea. I turned my will and my life over to him. I married a Mormon, you guys. I married a Mormon Marine, actually. Wow. And and I married him because I thought Mormon wives don't work. So he could go to work and I could pursue my dreams. And about 6 weeks after we got married, he got fired from his job. And I was like, you know what, God, that's not funny. And then like, I got like almost everything off my list that I wanted, except for being a famous movie star. I wanted to be a famous movie star. And I didn't get that, but I got everything else off the list that I wanted. And then my head went, we're going to have a drink now. We're going to have to. And I had this vision of what happened to me when I took that drink. And what I saw was if I took that next drink, I was going to be homeless on the streets pushing a shopping cart. And I did not think that I was going to do well in that position. But then the next thought was, but if this is what it's like to be sober, I don't want to live. And I meant it. The only thing was, is like I was just too afraid to kill myself because I didn't want to go to hell. That was it. I didn't want to go to hell. So what ended up happening is I went to the Monday night women's Mira Mesa meeting. And I don't know about you guys, but it seems to me like whenever somebody's on the brink of breaking, they always call on you to share at the meeting, right? So they called on me that night, and I just fell apart. I was like, I don't understand. I don't understand. I haven't had a drink for 3 years and 3 months, and I had a sponsor. I had gone to meetings. I had service commitments. I had worked the steps up to step 9 and done some amends, and I didn't understand. That's all I said is I don't understand. And a lady came up to me after the meeting. She goes, you're suffering from untreated alcoholism. And she said, if you want help, I'll help you. And she said, come to my house tomorrow and bring your big book. And so I went to her house the next day. I brought my big book. I also brought a folder with some pictures because, like, I was planning on telling her my story. And I was going to tell her with pictures, you know? So you guys know, like, I didn't say much, right? And I didn't get to open that folder. She did all the talking. We read out of the book, right? And she made Alcoholics Anonymous my number one priority. And it came before my husband. It came before work. It came before everything. And that was really hard on the marriage because that was not what I had. That was not what he and I had worked out. There was no AA in our agreement. But after a while, you know, I started going to the meet. I was going to a meeting every day. I had service commitments. I was meeting with my sponsor and I forget words now, you guys. I've gotten to that age. Sober sisters. I met with my sponsor and my sober sisters once a week. And, like, so now, like, I'm getting the AA dream, you know. Now I want to be sober in AA. I want my husband to go to Al-Anon. I want all the AA parties to be at our house. You know what I'm saying? Like, I got this. That's my new dream. And he wanted nothing to do with it. Absolutely nothing to do with it. He really resented my sponsor, and he resented Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not sure if I could have done it differently and if it would have worked out differently, but what ended up happening is I remember I went to take my four-year token, and he was supposed to give me my token, and he no-showed at the last minute. Yeah, because that's what he always did. That's how it worked. So anyway, the good news is, though, that I was really sad, but the good news is that, you know, I was really active in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of my sober sisters was there that night, and she stepped up, and she gave me my token that night. And I don't remember what she said, but I remember what happened when I got that token. And what happened is my heart changed. Like, how I'd been feeling about Alcoholics Anonymous was, like, I just want to be normal. I don't want to have to do all this crap in AA. I just want to be normal. I just want to get up every morning, go work out with my husband, go to work, come home, eat dinner, watch TV, and do it all over again the next day. That's all I wanted now, you know? And I couldn't do that because I had to do all this crap in AA. So what happened was when I got that token, I had been doing a bunch of prayers on my knees out loud, insincere prayers of gratitude. I didn't mean them. I didn't mean it at all. But every morning and every night, I got on my knees and I said, thank you, God, for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God, for making me an alcoholic. Thank you, God, for meetings. Thank you, God, for service commitments. Thank you, God, for my sober sisters. And thank you for my sponsor. I mean, honestly, I really didn't like my sponsor and she didn't like me either. You know what I'm saying? But that wasn't the point. I got on my knees every morning and every night and said those prayers out loud. And I went to a bunch of meetings and kept a bunch of commitments I didn't really want to keep. And then what happened when I got that four-year token is my heart changed from what do I got to do all this crap for to everything I do in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I do to say thank you to my higher power for giving me the grace and removing the desire for a drink from me. I had nothing, like, I didn't pray that prayer, it just happened. You know, God changed me from the inside out. I didn't have anything to do with it except for what I said I was doing, the actions that I was taking. And that's all my sponsor cared about was, what was I doing, you know? And that was part of the reason why I got on my knees and said my prayers out loud, because she was so invested in all my actions. So, well, I was kind of had a resentment against her, and that's why I did my prayers on my knees out loud. I didn't tell her that, but that was it, you know? So what happened after that was a lot of things happened. it's so funny. I kept trying to sponsor women, but they didn't. I couldn't get a sponsee to stay with me until I was like 6 years sober. Like, I don't know exactly what it was, but I tried to sponsor women, but they just did not want me to sponsor them. But I was very busy in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, keeping a lot of service commitments, working the steps, and doing stuff. And then one of the things that happened along the way is, I remember I was like 6 years sober, and my mom had a heart attack, and she was in Indiana. Now, she's young, 57, so I knew she was going to be okay, right? So what ended up happening was I didn't get on a plane and go home right away, but I did pray about it. And turns out that what I got from praying about it was, well, your mom doesn't really need you there after she's passed away. She could probably use your help now while she's sick. So I ended up buying a ticket and going home and helping out. My mom was in the ICU when I got there. And within a couple of days, they moved her into her own room. And she was supposed to go home on like a Tuesday or a Wednesday. And I remember I stayed up there with her the night. I spent the night, and my younger sister was supposed to come up. We had a rule in my family. Nobody's in the hospital by themselves. If anybody's in the hospital, somebody's always with them. So I was like 6 years sober. I spent the night, slept on the couch in my mom's room. Got up the next day. My sister was supposed to be there, but she was late. She was really late because she's always late. Did I mention she had a six-month-old baby, too, by any chance? Yeah. So she was dealing with that, too. So anyway, she said she was almost there, and so I left. I left, and I went home. And when I got home, the hospital called and said, we need you to come back up here. And so I said, my sister should be there. They're like, she's not here. And so I went back up there. And when I got up there, there was a priest waiting over here. And he was like, would you like to talk? I'm like, no, I don't want to talk to you. I'm Baptist. No, I'm just kidding. I didn't say that. I didn't say that, but I thought it, but I didn't want to talk to him, and and they took me in this room. There were a bunch of people in the room, and they nobody was talking. Everybody's just, like, sitting there with me, and I don't know them, and I'm like, what is, I don't understand what's going on, and they're like, oh, the doctor will be in a minute, and then the doctor came in, and he sat down next to me, and, you know, he had a, like, I guess her chart or whatever. And he was like, so this happened and this happened. And then we did this. And then this happened and we couldn't bring her back. And then he kept on talking. And I was like, does that mean my mom died? You know, like, I'm sitting there. Is that what that means? And as he kept talking, like, that's what he meant, you know? And, I felt so guilty for leaving my mom alone in the hospital. And I ended up staying back home for like 30 days with the family because it was just me, my brother, and my sister now. And my sister had that six-month-old baby. And so here's what happened. Every morning when I got up, I felt a lot of pain. I could just feel it like right here. And so what I would do is I would get up every morning and I would go to the 7 a.m. meeting and I would look for a newcomer to find to talk to them so that I could think about them and not think about what was going on in my life because it was just too much for me. And I did that every day, and like some of the old timers there got to know me and they kind of kept track of me, you know, like they were there to support me. I still have my support here, but this was like 1999. So it wasn't like cell phones and all that stuff, you know what I mean? Like it was messages on phone machines and stuff like that, you know what I mean? So it was different. So, you know, I'm here to report that the Alcoholics Anonymous in Evansville, by God, Indiana, is, you know, just the same as the Alcoholics Anonymous is here. And they stepped up with the love and fellowship to support me while I was back there. And then what happened after that, after I got back, I of course fell in love, but but don't worry, I didn't get married. He wasn't a Marine. I thought he was my guy. I thought he was the guy. I thought he was the guy like Beth and Chris. I thought he was that guy. I thought we were going to get married, and we were going to have babies, and we were going to live forever, you know, the rest of our lives together, happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. That didn't work out. But the thing is like, I remember, like, I don't think I've ever talked about this from the podium, but I remember when he and I broke up, and I don't know if you guys have ever realize that you've done something like this, but I don't like rejection, and I don't like being the rejector either. I don't like being the rejector, and I don't like being the rejectee. But apparently, I dislike being the rejector more than I dislike being the rejectee. And what I did was, is I manufactured a way for this guy to break up with me when I wanted to break up with him, but I couldn't do it. And after I did that, like, there was a big part of me that wanted to play victim. It really wanted to play the victim card because he broke up with me. And I heard in my brain went, you better take responsibility for this. If you don't, you'll drink. And it took me a long time to unwind that, but I did unwind it. Through doing the steps, working with a sponsor, telling the truth, going to meetings, trying to sponsor other women, you know, I'm able to tell you the truth right now, you know, about who I am and how I operate sometimes. Maybe it's too much. I've never shared this from the podium before, so I don't know who in here needed to hear that. But I hope you appreciate it, because I'm feeling really uncomfortable right now. So that happened. He wasn't the one. And then I was single for like 10 years. And I just kept, you know, I had my commitments at meetings. I would dress up and go to La Jolla Speakers every Saturday night looking for a date. And all I got were newcomers, sponsees, just so we're clear, female sponsees. That's all I got from that. And everybody in AA kept telling me, they kept saying, just get happy with yourself. And when you get happy with yourself, then somebody will show up. You know what? They tell people that because they don't know what else to say. That's what they do, you know? So I got a dog. That's what I... I did. I got a dog. He was my first dog as a grown-up. I loved him. His name was Alfredo. He was named after Sauce. Alfredo Sauce, because he was all white. I called him Fredo. And he was my best bud. And I was probably about... my sobriety date's November 8th, 1992. And I was probably about 20 years sober around then, and when all of this was happening. And then, like, shortly after I got a dog, I got the guy. So, girls, if you're single, get a dog. That's all I'm saying. No. So... I can't get a dog. It's different. I had cats all along. I finally got a dog. No. So another guy showed up, and he was hot, and we got involved in this relationship. And the only reason I don't know why I'm talking about all my relationships tonight. This is not Pamela. Can you attest that this is not the story I usually tell? Thank you. All right. So I don't know who needs to hear this. Maybe I do. I don't know. But I'm glad it's not being recorded. It is? Aren't you supposed to tell me that? I had four of you guys talk to me before the meeting. None of you guys said it was going to be recorded. Okay. So anyway, I got involved with this guy, and then I finally had the AA relationship. He was in love with I made him fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, actually, because, like, Alcoholics Anonymous was still the number one thing in my life, and so me doing that, he made Alcoholics Anonymous the number one thing in his life. And we didn't get married, even though he proposed. I'm really proud of that, you guys. Like, I didn't get married. But I was his caretaker the last year and a half of his life. And before that, I got cancer. I'm telling you guys all this because, like, I got cancer, and I was diagnosed in 2017. I had what's called olfactory neuroblastoma, which is right here. I had to have brain surgery. They didn't take out any of the stuff I wanted them to take out, though. So I was like, "Doc, can you take some of that stuff out?" He's like, "It don't work that way, Pam." But anyway, I got that in 2017, and then I went through all my treatment, and I recovered. And then in 2019, he got diagnosed with squamous cell cancer, and it was at the base of his tongue. And I just got to tell you, you know, without Alcoholics Anonymous, like, I don't know how I would have done that. Because I can promise you, that's not who I am without a program. Without a program and sponsor and service commitments and steps and prayer and meditation and all that good stuff. I'm not that person that would do that. And so he died May 20th, 2021, in the middle of COVID. And I went pretty crazy after that, you guys. After he passed, I went on a road trip. I tried to get a job overseas. I did all kinds of really outlandish things. And I still stayed in AA. I'm still grounded in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's still the most important thing in my life. It's the only thing that has changed me from the inside out. And I don't know if my talk tonight has been a good representation of actually what the steps have done for me, and being sober and being in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous have done for me, how my higher power has given me so much grace and so many opportunities and so many things in life, so many blessings in life that I never would have had I not been in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But now, I just turned 60 in May, and I never thought I'd be 60. You know, like, I'm not a, I mean, there are some things that I try to control, but I'm not a planner. Okay. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not planning for the future. I never thought about being 60. And I'm entering another new chapter of my life. Everything is new. And, but the thing is Alcoholics Anonymous is still my priority. And I really believe that as long as Alcoholics Anonymous stays my priority, as long as I work on having a relationship with a higher power, as long as I'm willing to do service. Like, I used to remember when I was new, like, people used to say, you can do anything you want in Alcoholics Anonymous, Pam. The only thing you can't do is drink. That's it. It's the only thing you can't do here. And I really found that to be true. I told you guys I wanted to be a famous movie star for about 5 years at the San Diego Spring Roundup. I wrote, directed, produced a variety show there. What I want to say about that is like I'm wired a certain way. I'm wired to do certain things. And I really believe God uses me wherever I'm at. And we had a lot of fun doing them shows at the Spring Roundup. We had a lot of fun. I'm really sad that COVID ruined that for us. But anyway, I'm not a famous movie star, but I wish I was telling you I got the relationship that I wanted and we lived happily ever after. That's the story I wish I was telling you, but that's not what happened. But other things in my life, I'm a writer now and I do stand-up comedy. I'm just still just trying to, one day at a time, be courageous, put myself out there, do the best I can, and stay sober and help somebody else stay sober. And I would never have the courage to do any of these things without Alcoholics Anonymous and a higher power. So I am gonna end a couple of minutes early. So I think that means I end up being a great speaker. So with that, I'll just say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous and thanks for listening to me. That's it.